on this edition for Saturday, July 25th, the latest on the coronavirus outbreak and how racial health inequities contribute to the spread. A week of memorials begins for Representative John Lewis.
He's on fire!
And the debate over the hot hand phenomenon. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. The United States remains the center of the coronavirus pandemic, with new confirmed infections near record highs. There were more than 72,000 confirmed new infections yesterday, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. On average, the daily number of positive tests has doubled over the last month. There were more than 1,100 deaths reported in the U.S. on Friday for the fourth consecutive day. In total, more than 145,000 people have died since late February, according to researchers at Johns Hopkins. In hotspots like Florida, Texas, and Arizona, new confirmed cases are not spiking like they were in recent weeks, but nationwide cases are still rising in more than three dozen states, according to data compiled by the New York Times. And nationwide, hospitalizations for the virus are near the record highs set back in mid-April. Worldwide, there are now more than 15.7 million confirmed cases of coronavirus and more than 640,000 deaths. In Brazil, President Jair Bolsonaro tweeted today that he's now negative for the coronavirus. Bolsonaro tested positive on July 7th after downplaying the severity of the pandemic. Brazil's outbreak is the worst in the world outside of the United States, with more than 2 million confirmed cases and 85,000 deaths. In Spain, health officials have struggled with regional spikes since lifting a nationwide lockdown 1 month ago. In the northeastern state of Catalonia, there have been nearly 8,000 new confirmed cases in the last 2 weeks. The French government is recommending that citizens not cross the border into Spain, and the Norwegian government mandated a 10-day quarantine for travelers returning from Spain. In Portland, Oregon last night, thousands of people demonstrated in the streets outside the federal courthouse. Protesters marched, shook a protective fence, and threw bottles and fireworks. Federal agents sent to the city despite opposition from local officials used tear gas at close range and flashbangs to disperse the crowds. Late yesterday, a federal judge denied a request from Oregon's Attorney General to restrict the actions of federal police sent to the city by the Trump administration. The state sought a restraining order, but a district judge ruled Oregon did not have standing in the case to sue on behalf of protesters. Demonstrations in Portland began after the murder of George Floyd in May and have continued nightly. State and local officials say the federal officers are making the situation worse. The acting Secretary of Homeland Security says the officers are protecting federal property. The president has called the demonstrators anarchists and agitators and is threatening to send federal agents to other cities. For the third straight week, thousands of protesters rallied in Russia's far eastern region of Khabarovsk today. The unusual public protests are in support of the region's former governor, who was arrested and sent to Moscow earlier this month on charges he murdered two businessmen 15 years ago. The governor, Sergei Furgal, defeated a candidate backed by President Vladimir Putin's party in 2018. Furgal supporters say the Kremlin is intruding in local affairs in an attempt to grab power in the region, which is seven time zones east of Moscow. The popular regional governor entered a plea of not guilty and remains in custody. Hanna is now the first hurricane of the 2020 Atlantic season as it moves toward the Texas Gulf Coast. The U.S. National Hurricane Center predicts Hanna will continue to strengthen and make landfall in Texas near Corpus Christi this evening. Storm surge and tornado warnings are also in effect. The area is one of several COVID-19 hotspots in the state. In the Caribbean, Tropical Storm Gonzalo may bring heavy rain to the southern Windward Islands, and Hawaii is preparing for Hurricane Douglas, a powerful storm that is predicted to pass very close to the islands or make landfall this weekend. For more on today's national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. A week of memorials honoring the late civil rights leader and member of Congress John Lewis began in his hometown of Troy, Alabama today. The casket bearing Lewis's body was brought to Troy University this morning. The service honored the boy from Troy, a name the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. gave to Lewis in the 1950s. Lewis died on July 17th at age 80 from pancreatic cancer. I spoke with Alabama Public Radio News Director Pat Duggins earlier today about the memorial service in Troy and tomorrow's planned procession from Selma to Montgomery. First, this is the beginning of a long series of days where we're going to be honoring John Lewis. What was special about Alabama? Why start here?
Well, because he grew up just outside of the city of Troy. I mean, he was the son of sharecroppers, and he experienced the same kind of racial discrimination that everyone did. He couldn't check books out of the library. There were the colored water fountains and the white water fountains. And one thing that was pointed out to me over the years is those colored water fountains had warm water, and then the white ones had cold water. So, I mean, if you're in Alabama in one of those 100-degree summer days, I mean, it's pretty awful. So Alabama turned out to be kind of like a battleground, not only for him, but also for Dr. King, but for his family who attended en masse for this event today. It was kind of it was a homecoming for them. And some of the stories they told were really heartwarming, really kind of give you a side of John Lewis you didn't know about.
What struck you? What's an example of something that we are unlikely to hear when it comes to the sort of professional eulogies that might happen later in the week?
Well, his sister confided that he was afraid of thunder and lightning. And no one ever called him John. I mean, if you wanted to know somebody who really knew John Lewis well, they always called him Robert. And then one time, because that's his middle name, and then one time his brother Henry was eulogizing him and said, you know, the first time that that John was being sworn into Congress, up on stage, he threw me a big thumbs up. And then afterwards, I walked up to him and said, why did you give me a thumbs up from? And John said, man, we've come a long way from Alabama, haven't we?
So what all is planned in Alabama now after this service that we saw today?
Well, there's going to be a service tonight at Brown AME Church in Selma, which is one of the marshalling areas for the voting rights marches that John Lewis took part in 1965 when he and the others were attacked on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Then tomorrow, there's going to be a procession over the bridge, which is where Lewis and all of his friends wanted to go, you know, during the fight for voting rights. And then tomorrow, also, there's going to be a moment where he's laid in state at the Alabama Capitol. Then on Monday, he'll be people will be able to pay their respects at the U.S. Capitol. And then on Wednesday, he comes back to Atlanta, and he'll lay in state there, and then he'll be interred during a family-only affair just outside of Atlanta.
What's been the reaction like from his birthplace this past week?
Well, if you ask his family, it was kind of like a homecoming. I mean, there was singing during the memorial ceremony today. There was dancing. I may be being a bit of a curmudgeon, but it struck me that the event started at 10 a.m. Central Time sharp, and it took 17 minutes before the first African-American person got to talk. So you've got that going on. You've got the head of Troy University saying, oh, well, back in the day, we wouldn't even allow him to, to enter the university. And later on, we gave him an honorary doctorate. How about that? The state troopers that were part of the attacking squad in 1965 during Bloody Sunday were the ones now looking over his casket, which is obviously draped with the American flag. So one small sign of how things have changed. But then I read an Associated Press account while I was getting ready for this interview about how the police chief at Troy University was suspended because he went on social media and said that George Floyd contributed to his own death. So things are changing. Things are not changing. It's kind of glacial. And unfortunately, John Lewis didn't see it to its fruition. He got a lot done, but still clearly a lot left to do.
Pat Duggins, Alabama Public Radio. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Harding.
As protests for Black Lives Matter continue across the country, many state and local leaders have declared racism a public health crisis. This comes as coronavirus cases are disproportionately impacting communities of color. One of the many institutions facing a reckoning of sorts is the healthcare system itself. I spoke recently with Dr. Rhea Boyd, a California-based pediatrician and public health advocate who says structural racism in the healthcare system is only compounding the public health crisis. This pandemic and also our reckoning with race has brought a couple of different big ideas together, which is that there are unequal health outcomes for Americans based on the color of their skin. How does the healthcare system play in to these inequities?
You know, that's a really critical question, and it's not one that we often ask. But our healthcare system and how it distributes resources to populations based on their racial and ethnic identities absolutely shapes the racial health inequities we see emerging generally and right now in the pandemic. One example of that is the insurance marketplace. Our healthcare system offers you healthcare based on your insurance access, but we know that that access tiers the quality of care that patients receive, and there's been data to suggest that it racially segregates the care that patients receive. Those are examples of how business models in healthcare drive broader inequities, and there are reasons why we need universal healthcare in the United States.
You know, we have heard about, for example, maternal mortality statistics for Black women and how they're worse. I mean, what are the systemic failures that get Black women to a position where that outcome, well, I guess really isn't paid attention to enough? But when you think about it throughout the life cycle of a person of color in America, what are those gaps that we take for granted?
So racial health inequities, like the maternal mortality gap, like the infant mortality gap, they reveal legacies and current practices of racial exclusion and discrimination in our country. They reflect who has access to safe environments, clean water, fresh air, and who doesn't. Who has access to healthcare, like we've already mentioned, who has access to employment in industries that might offer certain protections that during this pandemic might keep people more safe, things like paid sick leave or parental leave, or even just access to PPE. All of those critical supports are racially distributed in our society, and there are reasons why we see broad inequities generally and specific inequities right now during the pandemic.
During the pandemic, what we've also seen is a disproportionate amount of impact on healthcare workers of color. What can we do to try to restructure a workforce that, well, kind of relies on the labor of all Americans, but it seems that some of the tasks that are at higher risk or putting these people at higher risk are falling disproportionately on people of color?
This is one of the devastating things about how racism works in society. Even being a member of a protected workforce like healthcare during a pandemic still isn't enough to keep Black folks, Filipino workers like you mentioned, Latinx folks, and Indigenous populations safe. Because when they leave their jobs, they still go back to structurally unequal living conditions. And that's what really puts people at risk.
How do you incentivize equitable outcomes? I mean, as you mentioned, there are pretty powerful forces. How do you make sure that there are these outcomes in the long run that people can get together around?
In healthcare, one way to do that is with government regulation. I think government regulation is one of the hallmarks of anti-discrimination advances throughout society, that you need the government to say that certain things are allowed and certain things aren't allowed, that certain things are rights and other things are privileges. And I think in this country, we need to say really firmly, and we need our government to say it for all of us, that healthcare is a right, that everyone should have access to it, and that our government will invest in ensuring that that's a possibility. That then would create incentives, financial and moral, within healthcare to ensure that everybody has access to that right.
As workplaces go through their own reckonings on race, what should the healthcare industry, what should doctors and hospitals know and study about racism before they practice their craft?
So racism hurts people, and we know it contributes to premature mortality for all racial and ethnic groups in this country. And that means doctors need to better understand the mechanisms by which racism harms health. In medicine, we need to make understanding the impacts of racism on health a professional competency. Every clinician should know it.
Finally, I want to ask, are you concerned about the vaccines that may arise for COVID-19 and how that plays out. I mean, whether there's equal access to the vaccine, whether there's equal adoption, depending on where you live and the color of your skin.
Absolutely. Healthcare services aren't distributed equitably in our society, and racial and ethnic minoritized groups tend to be excluded. And so I do have concerns that if a vaccine is created and it isn't made freely available to everyone, that costs will be a huge barrier to folks getting it.
Heading into this fall, we know that influenza comes back, and we know that not everybody gets a flu vaccine when they have a chance to. If people choose not to take the influenza vaccine, choose not to take the COVID-19 vaccine, what kinds of situations are we setting ourselves up for?
I think we have to prepare for a reality where at least half of adults may not get the COVID vaccine, similar to the same half of adults who don't get the influenza vaccine. We need to prepare for it. And what I mean by that is we need to institute universal protections for everybody. The government has to enable all Americans to wear a mask. It has to make testing available to all Americans routinely, not just once, routinely, so that as folks' exposures change, they also can change how they move throughout the world so that they don't risk infecting others. We also have to provide income supports. We need another federal relief package so that folks can safely stay home from work if they're sick, and so that folks can still pay their rent and stay in separate living facilities so that they don't, expose others potentially.
All right. Dr. Rhea Boyd, pediatrician and public health advocate. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sports in the United States are finally back, sort of. Baseball kicked off an abbreviated 60-game season this week, and basketball starts today with the WNBA, followed by the NBA later this week. Players, staff, and media are quarantined, everyone is tested for COVID-19 regularly, and the games are being played with no fans in attendance. But the extraordinary circumstances of this season won't change a familiar phenomenon. Players will go on streaks where they just can't seem to miss. Athletes will tell you the so-called hot hand is undeniable, but how do you know when you have it? And crucially, does it even exist? In a new book, Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Cohen chronicles the research behind these streaks, and in this interview, taped right before the NBA season shut down in March, we started by talking about a virtual court. In the 1993 video game NBA Jam, teams of two play a souped-up, exaggerated version of basketball. But there was one feature of the game that basketball fans everywhere recognized. After a player made three shots in a row, he could not miss.
He's on fire!
We wanted to get to that point where we heard those three magical words. This game was seductive to kids of a certain generation, and part of it was because of the hot hand.
That's the name of Ben Cohen's recent book, which delves into a question that has vexed economists and psychologists for decades, whether the hot hand exists. While Cohen says that NBA Jam codified the hot hand for a generation of video game players, for many sports fans, its existence is as simple as watching the Golden State Warrior Stephen Curry. Cohen covers the NBA for the Wall Street Journal, and he writes about a night in February of 2013 where Curry seemingly could not miss.
That guy is hot.
Curry for three. Wow!
Curry made 11 of his 13 three-pointers, finishing the night with 54 points, the most he has ever scored in one game. Curry's legendary hot hand that night helped propel him to superstardom.
In many ways, that game was an inflection point in his career. What he likes to say is that he doesn't know when he's going to be hot, he doesn't know where he's going to be hot, he doesn't know why he might be hot. But once he does get hot, he has to embrace it. And that's what he did that night against the Knicks.
But was Curry's performance the result of a hot hand where making one basket made hitting the next one more likely? Or are we seeing patterns where there might just be a statistical anomaly?
There is a real generational debate about whether there is such a thing as the hot hand. Mm-hmm. And all of that started with the publication of a paper in 1985 with this counterintuitive conclusion, which is that there is no such thing as the hot hand. It's simply a misreading of randomness.
Psychologists Thomas Gilovich, Robert Vallone, and Amos Tversky had Cornell University undergraduates shoot baskets from where they statistically made about half of their shots. They also used data collected by the Philadelphia 76ers during the 1980-81 season. It was the only team in the NBA that kept track of consecutive shots during games.
Not too long ago, even just the basic chronology of basketball shots was this motherload of data. And what happened once they analyzed that data was that they showed that you were actually no more likely to make your next shot after making two or three shots in a row.
Cohen says the findings by three academics did not necessarily change the minds of the basketball world.
One lucky reporter actually got to tell the great Boston Celtics coach Red Auerbach about this paper. And Red Auerbach sort of sneered and says, like, what is this? I don't care about these professors. Like, they make a study. I couldn't care less. And that was generally the view among basketball players because we'd all felt the hot hand, right? We'd seen the hot hand. And here were these professors coming along and telling us there was no such thing.
Cohen details how this is not just a phenomenon among athletes. From investors to gamblers to even artists, success often appears to come in bunches. But thinking you see a streak when you might just be seeing a pattern in randomness can also have negative consequences.
That is one of the central points of the original paper. Not only is there no such thing, but believing in the hot hand is a costly illusion.
Cohen writes about a 2016 study that looked at hundreds of thousands of asylum decisions by immigration judges.
What they found was that when asylum judges grant asylum to two or three refugees in a row, they're much less likely to grant asylum to a fourth applicant.
Regardless of what the case is.
Regardless of the merits of the case. The where and the what and the why was actually less important than the when in this case. Now, that's crushing. It's not Steph Curry missing a shot. It's someone maybe having to go back to their home country where they fear persecution. And the reason this happens is because these judges are trying to even out the probabilities in their own minds, right? They feel like, I have given asylum three times in a row. I shouldn't give to a fourth. I should try to regress to the mean.
In other words, judges do not want to look like they are on a streak. It's a similar perception to the one that makes us believe that a player who has made several shots in a row will make the next. But an NBA player shooting a basketball is not the same thing as deciding an immigration case, and an advanced stats revolution in the NBA has upended research on the existence of the hot hand.
What we have now is data that wasn't available to those researchers in their nerdiest, wonkiest dreams. Like, the world has changed, and sometimes when the world changes, you have to question long-held assumptions.
Since 2013, every arena in the NBA has had cameras that track all of the action on the court. The data allows for the quantification for exactly how hard each shot is, tracking precisely where a player is and whether someone is trying to stop him.
These researchers found that you were actually slightly likely to make your next shot. The ball is not turning into a fireball, but this was some of the first evidence to come along to suggest that maybe our intuition was right all along. And in certain circumstances, there is such a thing as the hot hand.
This tracking data is not the only update to research on the hot hand. More recent evidence of its existence has come from a counterintuitive finding by two economists using coin flips.
What they found was that if you flip coins in a sequence and you take the probability of getting a heads or a tails after another heads or a tails, it's actually not 50%, as we have been conditioned to believe forever. It's actually closer to 42 or 43%. It's mind-boggling. It's kind of trippy math. Even people who have looked at this paper and studied it and peer-reviewed it and published it have trouble wrapping their minds around it. But if you think about that in terms of the hot hand, it means that when you're shooting 50%, you're actually exceeding probability, right? You are, as they might say, on fire. And everybody had missed this for 35 years because it's very counterintuitive mathematically.
It's a finding that made national news when it was published as a working paper in 2015. And it's caused the living authors of the 1985 paper, which said there was no such thing as a hot hand, to re-examine their original findings.
They're still experimenting with the hot hand. I was up at Cornell to see a shooting experiment in a basketball gym, not unlike the one that happened 35 years ago. So where this data leads us, I don't think any of us quite know yet, but they are some of the people who are most anxious to find out.
Finally tonight, longtime television host Regis Philbin has died. Philbin is best known as co-host of daytime talk shows with Kathy Lee Gifford and Kelly Ripa for 23 years, and as the first U.S. host of the game show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. In a statement, his family said Philbin died Friday night of natural causes. He was 88 years old. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular's goal has been to provide wireless service that helps people communicate and connect. We offer a variety of no-contract plans, and our U.S.-based customer service team can help find one that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.